Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Red Fox Blogger with your host, Kel Fritzy.
You may not be paid for the job. Can some of you evening, and good afternoon, and good morning, wherever you're listening on the planet. Welcome to the Red Fox Blogger with your humble hosts, Tim Burton and Kel Fritzing. You'll notice at the beginning that you heard, "Welcome to the Red Fox Blogger with your host, Kel Fritzing." That is my Friday opening. I quickly remedied that because on Mondays, of course, I am co-hosting with Tim Burton. Hi, Tim.
Well, good evening, Kel, and how the devil are you? Don't worry about leaving me off the credits. It isn't a problem.
I'm doing devilishly well.
Good, good. I'm very glad to hear it. That's no trouble at all. I mean, it's I know that even if you don't include me on there, I'm with you in spirit and vice versa, so there's no problem. And
kidding? We're glued at the hip.
We certainly are, Kel. We certainly are.
The fox and the cat.
The fox and the cat. Yes.
Absolutely.
Who can defeat
but
us?
How are you doing, Tim?
I'm doing really well, thank you. I've had an excellent day today. I found out a little bit more about my upcoming venue at the local magistrates'
tribunal,
court.
Tribunal.
They might call it tribunal in Canada. It's just referred to as the magistrates' court over here. Or up before the beak, as we say in English colloquial slang, up before the beak.
There you go. Can you do a solid? Give a brief background and share the good news that you got today, please.
Certainly. I'll be very happy to do it. There are some details I won't be able to give completely until I've had some word back from my solicitor. But basically, as our listeners probably know, I had a little bit of a run-in with a very famous member of the British establishment over here, a chap by the name of Fiaz Mughal, OBE. OBE, for anybody who doesn't know, stands for Order of the British Empire. He's a very highly thought of person, so highly thought of, in fact, that the Queen herself had these very words to say. "Oi, oi, 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 Fiaz," she said, "get this medal stuck on your chest and carry on with the good work." Now, I believe those were her very words. But anyway, Fiaz Mughal runs an organisation called Tell Mama UK, an organisation, I might say, that's built on a false premise. The premise is that Islam is a benign and tolerant religion of peace, and therefore anybody who is opposed to it must be a hateful, racist, bigoted Islamophobe. And it's been operating under this premise for a number of years now, taking oodles of British taxpayers' cash in order to carry on with its good work, which is to scour the internet for examples of online hate crime. All well and good, you might think, until it was exposed last June by the Telegraph newspaper over in the United Kingdom as a manipulator of statistics, or which is to say Fiaz Mughal himself, who's the owner of or director of Tell Mama UK, was hauled in front of his paymasters, the Department of Communities and Local Government, and told that his figures didn't add up. And the Association of Chief Police Officers agreed with that assessment, at which point Fiaz Mughal threw all his toys out of the pram and stormed out of the room in a tantrum and subsequently had his funding withdrawn. And that's hundreds of thousands of pounds, British pounds, of taxpayers' money every year for the last 5 years. Exactly. So he wasn't best pleased, apparently, when he received some tweets from me suggesting that his character was less than 100% wholesome. In fact, I referred to him as a grievance-mongering, lying, Muslim, mendacious scumbag, at which point he set the dogs on me. And I had a couple of very nice police officers call round, and they had a very nice chat with me down at the local police station, cups of tea and everything, no expense spared, and even volunteered to look after my laptop and my mobile phone for me.
Oh.
while they assessed the evidence. And at the end of all that, I was charged with racially aggravated harassment, because apparently it's a crime these days in the UK to speak your mind, especially on Twitter, and especially about a member of the British establishment who's so highly thought of by our dear Queen. Consequently, the police were anxious, very anxious, to do the bidding of Mr. McGull, and I was duly charged, and I'm due at the moment to come up in court on the 18th of February. I have discovered one fact. I've only recently been given some of the papers that are relevant to my case, and I have discovered that when Mr. McGull was giving his statement to the police in order to get them to send out the squad cars and get me arrested, that he was economical with the actuality, as they say in Canada. Do you like my Canadian accent there, Kel?
You have a terrible French accent.
Oh, thank you very much, Kel. That's the kindest thing anybody.
No, it's perfect. Actually, your French accent is much better than mine. So carry on.
Well, anyway, he was economical with the actuality to the extent that I assessed the degree of it, and there is a case for going back with my solicitor to take Mr. McGull to task over it. Now, I can't say too much about it at the moment, but I do note in the Crown Prosecution Service guidelines that they do say that you are economical with the actuality, and it affects it directly and materially affects a charge which is brought against somebody, it could be punishable by severe porridge time. Again, another little phrase that we like to use over here, but I shouldn't really say too much more about it, because I don't know, a lot of things can happen in between the time that you submit something to a solicitor and the time that actually translates into action in the criminal justice system. So all I will say at the moment is it should be an interesting case, and for those of you who happen to be in Birmingham, England, on the afternoon of the 18th of February this year, and you've got nothing to do, buy yourself a bag of popcorn and come along and sit in the at the back of the court, because it's going to prove, I think, to be an interesting case. And that's really all I should say about that at the moment.
Oh, yeah. And people, please do get there in Birmingham and February 18th, and do sit in the galley and bring your popcorn and toss it at the back of the head of the complainant. Free the Birmingham one.
We can't really encourage that kind of behavior in a British court.
All right, okay.
I know,
Tim, you know me. You know me. I'm exuberant.
I know you do things slightly differently in Canada, you know, but over in England, I have to say, they take a dim view of people throwing popcorn around in the courtroom. But if anybody is interested in helping out, I would like, Kel has very kindly set up a site where you can, if you wish, donate some money towards my legal defence costs and towards the cause of freedom, because what this is about is far more than a simple racially aggravated harassment case. It is to do with the fundamentals of freedom of speech, what we can and can't say in public, how we can and can't express ourselves when public figures do things that are reprehensible. There are vast ramifications, and every freedom loving person who happens to be listening to this show, please support us in whichever way.
Oh, Tim, and absolutely. And ladies and gentlemen, you can go to www.gofundme.com, all lowercase, /60RSSS, and help Tim. You can donate safely via PayPal, because this is costing Tim money. This is costing him pennies. And Tim, I think that as a fellow counter-jihadist calling out the truth and being what I consider persecuted, but, you know, he's actually being prosecuted. I consider this an absolute injustice, and I have been hot about this for weeks now, as my listeners know. So, yes, www.gofundme.com/60RSSS, and the page will come right up, and that is to help Tim Burton. Please let us show our solidarity and get Tim out of this as well. Get him through that cat flap.
Well, I suppose the last thing I'd like to say about it is that I'm not particularly concerned myself about my own acquittal or conviction. Although it would be nice not to be hung, drawn, quartered, and sentenced to 7 years transportation. There is a real prospect of jail time for the racially aggravated harassment charge. So it is actually quite serious. But as Kel said, if you can support in any way, then please do, and we'll be mentioning this from time to time as new developments unfold, and if anybody wants to contact me directly to ask me a question, you can reach me. I think Kel's got my email details on the front of the website, or
they are right in the show notes. There. Even for the archive listeners, Tim's links are right up there. And just to let you know as well, Liberty GB also has a website up there, and that's libertygb.org.uk. And if you click on Truth is Never a Hate Crime, Help Tim Burton's Defense, they also have a website up there where you can PayPal, donate via PayPal, and help Tim get through this, because Tim Burton is also, and I'm speaking about Tim in the third person now, oh my goodness, Tim, you're also
that,
the radio host on Liberty GB, and that you had been charged by West Midlands Police with racially aggravated harassment, as you said, and you're right, you were doing nothing except calling out Fayez Mago for what he was. He's a mendacious, grievance mongering taquilla artist. What did you say that was so wrong that would get you hauled into a courtroom coming February 18th?
Well, there were several things. I mean, apart from calling him a mendacious, grievance-mongering taquilla artist, it's entirely possible that I may have, due to being beyond offended, beyond outraged, and absolutely incensed when I read the original Telegraph article, I did actually use intemperate language, ladies and gentlemen, injudicious language, one might say. I actually used the words lying Muslim scumbag at one point. I was so upset and angry. And sure enough, the police officers, being highly trained officers of the law, spotted this straight away. It was one of the first questions they asked me in interview, you know, why did you call him a lying Muslim scumbag? And I did say, well, it is possible that the word scumbag may have been somewhat intemperate. I think those were my very words. We had a good old chuckle.
You hurt his little feelings, that's why.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he didn't like
big
that.
Time. Like,
that's right. I mean, he was certainly, without question, he was certainly offended and insulted. But it's not actually a crime to offend and insult people. But what he also said was that he was threatened and harassed and distressed and alarmed at the contents and nature of my tweets. And I would say no reasonable person would realistically find themselves to be threatened, harassed, distressed, or alarmed. I mean, obviously, that is for the courts to decide. But my main purpose in sending the tweets that I did was to have a chastening effect on him, to let him know that when a public figure like him performs in such a way in public office as director of an organisation taking hundreds of thousands of pounds of taxpayers' money, we expect
absolutely.
These we expect these people to be held to very high standards. And if they're not, if they don't hold themselves to very high standards, I think we have every right to vent our spleen. And venting my spleen was exactly what I was doing. I've got no interest in threatening him or harassing him or making him distressed or alarmed, but I have got an interest in making him feel chastened, making him feel that he's being chastised by the court of public opinion. And that was my intention behind the tweet. I mean, I'm saying this all this with hindsight, because when I was asked that question in the interview, you know, why did you do it? I just said, well, I felt angry and I felt incensed, and I hadn't really thought my statement.
Well, you understood something that this guy, Tim, here come these fake names again. You understood that he was shysting the British taxpayer. What is wrong with you speaking out and saying, look, there is something going on here? And I know that Twitter is considered the wild, wild west at times, but you know what? Twitter is also a vanguard of free speech, or so we hope.
Yes.
And that you had an opinion about this shyster, and he is Fias, I don't care. I don't even care to pronounce
the
gremlin name right, but
wasn't it something like that?
If he's listening, hey, come on. You know, Fias, as a matter of fact, call into the program. Come on.
Yeah,
the phone number is 347-237-4318. Come on. Share your hurt feelings.
Share your hurt feelings. But yeah, it's all to do with did he feel threatened, harassed, distressed, and alarmed? And I would argue that no reasonable person would feel that. But in British law, it's not so much what I feel; it's what the other person says he feels. And so it'll be up to me to prove whether or not that was a reasonable thing. The last thing I want to say is that. If you're running that sort of an organization and you're actively on the lookout for online hate crimes, you actually want and need hateful, racist, bigoted Islamophobes like me to send hateful, racist, bigoted tweets like that so that you can justify your immense salary and the wads of public cash from the British taxpayer. You actually need it. So far from feeling threatened, harassed, distressed, or alarmed when you get these tweets, you should be rubbing your hands together with glee. You should be jumping with joy on top of your desk and doing backflips around the office. Threatened, harassed, distressed, alarmed? I don't think so, ladies and gentlemen. I don't think so.
And I could, you know, and that's the thing. And ladies and gentlemen, you have to understand that I get rather animated when we discuss this, because just be forewarned, we will be discussing this quite heavily within the ensuing programs down the road, because this is our Tim. This is Cat Strangler 101, who is being taken to task for tweeting the truth. And if you can please click on those links that I put in the chat room, and I also have them at the Red Fox Blogger. Blogspot.com. Please, this is costing our Tim out of pocket. This is totally unfair. He did absolutely nothing wrong. But Tim, you are also saying, what's the good news you got today?
Well, the good news is that there may well be some mileage in the charge of perverting the course of justice that I referred to at the start of the program. I can't really say a great deal more until such time.
I got you. I'm sorry. I was listening a little too closely because the wheels were turning in my head as I got more and more angered about it.
Yeah, the thing was, I didn't actually get these papers until this weekend, which is, you know, about 6 weeks after I was charged. And I looked at these papers, and something wasn't right, and I couldn't think what it was. And I woke up at about 4 o'clock in the morning on Saturday morning, and I thought, let me just read that again. And sure enough, there it was in black and white. As I say, I can't go into too much detail at the moment, but it showed to me quite clearly that he was, when I say economical with the actualité, that is the British way of saying he lied his little Muslim head off. Just for in case of for some of you who think that it was nothing more than a slight bending of the words, it wasn't. It was an actual fib, ladies and gentlemen. And I intend to make sure that the appropriate authorities are aware of it, because when you make a police statement, you are not supposed to fib. I can't say too much more, but I will at the next stage of the investigation.
And don't say too much more, but you have somebody here by the name of Mike Holt who would like to have a word with you. But before I do that, Tim, this is for you. We are so in your corner, and I'm bringing Mike on right now to have a word with you. Hi, Mike. How are you tonight?
How are you?
I'm doing very well. Welcome to the Red Fox Blogger with your host Tim Burton and Kel Fritzy. And you've been listening to what Tim has been discussing.
Yes, I have. It's very interesting. And Tim, I wish you all the best with this, and I hope you win greatly.
Well, thank you very much for that, Mike. There are some things which I'm sure will happen in between now and the trial date. But as I said to Kel, I shouldn't really go into too much detail until I've got things formalised with the solicitor. But it was certainly a very, very interesting discovery that I made at the weekend that materially affects my case. And as developments occur and as I'm able to speak about them in more detail, then I certainly will let everybody know. But it's certainly going to shape up to be a very, very interesting case, I think.
Yeah, well, I think it goes a lot deeper than that, though, because this all comes back to the problem that we're having with Islam. And, you know, as Geert Wilders said, the Quran is a fascist book which incites violence. That is why this book, just like Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf, must be banned. The book incites hatred and killing and therefore has no place in our legal order. Well, it goes even further than that, because it's not just the fascism and everything. They lie, they cheat, they will do anything they can to further the cause of Islam, and they're trying to destroy our civilization. It's we put a stop to it.
Oh, indeed. I mean, that is actually another aspect of the case that I hadn't actually touched on when I was talking to the listeners just now. But you're quite right, of course, that the Quran does allow for lying and cheating in the name of Islam. If it furthers the cause of Islam, then it's perfectly acceptable for Muslims to lie with a clear conscience. And that's something that's quite different, of course, from everything in our Judeo-Christian civilization and our traditions and our values. Of course, people do lie in our civilization, but it's generally thought of as a bad thing, whereas in Islam it is not the case, because as we know, Islam's moral values are completely inverted compared to our moral values. And this is part of the problem, that a lot of people in positions of authority have lost sight of the fact that there is such a thing as good and evil, and we are on the side of good, and Islam most definitely is not. And the lying and cheating aspect is something that's extremely important, because I'm sure when Fiaz Maghal was taking all that money under false pretenses from Tel Mama UK and his other organisations that he runs, I'm sure he did that with a clear conscience, because it was lying and cheating to further the cause of Islam. And that's a perfectly acceptable thing to do. Islamically speaking, he wasn't doing anything wrong at all. But yeah, you take that case and you multiply it by a million, but with all the, or 100 million by all the other Muslims that are currently living in Western countries and whatever they might be doing to further the cause of Islam, as every good Muslim should. And you can imagine there's a whole lot of lying and cheating going on, as the song has it. Or if it doesn't, then it should.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. And they're not discriminatory about it. They lie and cheat themselves too.
Oh, yeah.
It's a terrible religion. Well, actually, it's not a religion. As it says, it's a fascist organization. And the way they treat people here, even in Australia, I've been talking to some of the companies that are paying the halal certification, religious tax on our food. And they tell me they have no choice but to pay. Otherwise, they lose their business. And this is pure mafia-style standover tactics.
Oh, indeed, yeah. I mean, it is much more like a mafia organisation than it is a religion. And of course, when we talk about it, there are many grounds for saying that it's not a religion at all, first and foremost. It's first and foremost a political totalitarian ideology. It has religious overtones, for sure, and it's the religious overtones that give it the cover that it needs to perform all these nefarious deeds in our relatively tolerant and trusting Western society. So it should lose all the religious privileges it currently has. It currently enjoys a lot of religious privileges in every Western country, and those should be taken away. It should, at the very least, be classified as a political ideology and not a religion. And if we were totally honest about it, it's a cult. It's a cult. But I would argue that if we were to designate it as a political ideology in particular, we could treat it in the same way that we would have treated or that we did treat Nazism in the 1930s, which was a political ideology with a charismatic person at its head. Islam is a political ideology with a charismatic person at its head, and millions of devout followers of Islam are perpetrating all manner of nefarious things in our Western societies under cover of it being a religion, which, of course, it's nothing of the sort. And even if you were to say it was a religion, it's certainly not the benign and tolerant and peaceful religion that Muslims tell you it is. And I could go on at length explaining why that isn't, but I'm sure most of our listeners are familiar with those arguments. Although if anybody isn't familiar with the arguments and wants to write to me directly, please refer to my email address on the front of the Blog Talk Radio website. I've gone on at some length, Mike. I do apologise. I'll hand the mic back to you.
No, this is important. This is really, really important, Tim. We have a topic tonight that we will get to momentarily. But this is, ladies and gentlemen, you have to be apprised of what happens when you take on the role of being a counter-jihadist. This is what you're up against, and this is what Tim is up against right now. And I also want to apprise people that Mike Holt is the proprietor of Restore Australia. He is the gentleman behind the sticker campaign, the Halal sticker campaign. And to also apprise you, Mike Holt has his very own radio show right here on Blog Talk Radio, Wednesday afternoons at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 6 a.m. in Mike's neck of the woods in Australia, and I'm his producer. So I put the links in the show notes. Not the show notes. I put the links in the chat room there for you, Mike.
Yes, thank you. Actually, it's 6 a.m. in Queensland, but 5 a.m. in New South Wales and Victoria, because they have daylight savings. So Queensland, as usual, is always just a little bit behind, but that's the way we like it. We're very laid back here. But
yeah.
I woke up this morning, went out the front door, and guess what? Somebody's thrown eggs at my house. Now, I don't know if this is a warning or what. I hope it's only just kids playing around them, but it seems a bit strange that there would be eggs thrown at my house. So we're moving. I'm not going to take any risks with my kids. In fact, at the moment, I'm involved in a court case against the Muslim made threats. Yeah, this Muslim made death threats against me last September, August, September. I've been down to the police station yesterday to sign the statement, and that will be going down to the New South Wales Police in Sydney, where they have tracked down this Muslim, and he will be arrested and charged with various crimes on the internet, including making death threats. So they are down here in Australia. They are starting to make trouble, just as they've been doing it in Europe. And if we don't resist them now, we're going to end up in the same boat as the UK in the EU. So you will not stop me, Islam. I will not stop until you are banned from Australia. And to make sure of that, on my website, restoreaustralia.org.au, I'm selling these little black stickers with a skull and crossbones on it that says ban Islam. And people are clasping these things all over Australia. Keep it up, Australia. I'm here and you're here. And we are not going to give our country over to the Islamists.
Yes,
absolutely not.
well said, Mike.
Please, on Wednesday on your radio program, heard here on Blog Talk Radio, Wednesday afternoons, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 8 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, and 6 a.m. AST Time. Please be here. Mike will have a follow-up for that to share with you. Right, Mike?
Yeah, I will.
Okay.
Although at this stage, not sure what the eggs really mean. Hopefully, it's not sinister, but you never know, do you?
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Yes. It's always a worry, of course, for people who stand up against Islam, and I feel that things will get, not specifically for you, Mike, but in general terms, that things will get worse before they get better, because at the moment the Muslims have enjoyed, in most Western countries, they've enjoyed a pretty good run. They've been allowed to expand pretty much unrestrained and unchecked wherever they've gone, and they've been accommodated by everybody who needs to accommodate them in authority in terms of allowing them to build mosques. The halal certification mafia scheme, of course, which is predominant in or is heavily promoted in Australia, and I believe it goes on in pretty much every Western country to greater or lesser extent. That's another area that they've allowed to expand pretty much unchecked in. And of course, they get all sorts of other associated benefits and accommodations in education and in public services that ordinary indigenous people in those countries don't get at all. And that sooner or later, one of two things is going to happen. They're either going to take over completely, which, as long as I draw breath, that is never going to happen, or there's going to be a pushback. And if there's a pushback, you can't expect them to take it peacefully. They are going to object, and they're going to object in ways great or small, and it won't be pleasant. But it's one of those things that we are all going to have to accept will have to be part of the price to be paid for allowing them to gain to make as much inroads as they have done in our countries, which is has been facilitated by our political elites and mainstream media and so on. But the fact that they've got this far, they're not going to give up without a fight, no matter how much we'd like to. I would hope that we would be able to accomplish our goals without too much in the way of blood on the streets. I personally think that if there was enough political will, it could be done really quite painlessly. People on the left would obviously scream discrimination and say how bad it is to discriminate against Muslims, and there'd be people shouting racism and Islamophobia from all over the place. But at the end of the day, we are going to have to make a decision as to whether our Judeo-Christian civilization is worth defending or not. I personally think it is worth defending, because the traditions and values that have made our civilization what it is arguably represent the greatest framework for the future development of humanity, bar none. it's not perfect for everybody all the time. I would never say that it is, but I think when you're talking about what's the greatest good for the greatest number, it's streets ahead of anything that Islam could possibly come up with. The Islamic civilizational model is all well and good if you just want to conquer the entire world through fear, intimidation, violence and bloodshed. But it's no good at all if you want to live in peace with your next door neighbour. It's totally useless for that as a civilizational mm-hmm. model. And it explains the fact that wherever Islam does rule, on pretty much every measurable scale, the populations that live there live in the most miserable poverty-ridden circumstances, apart from a happy few who have loads and loads of money and can lord it over the rest of them. Pretty much everybody else gets the brown-coloured end of the stick, as they say. You can look at pretty much every measurable scale, whether it's infant mortality, whether it's the longevity in the population, general health, educational standards, art and literature, scientific achievements, pretty much every measurable scale. Those are just a few that I've mentioned, but you could take pretty much every measurable scale, and countries that are ruled using the Islamic model of civilization perform very poorly, and it's because of Islam. Islam is the problem.
I've seen it myself.
And Mike, I'm going to let you wrap up your last point before Tim and myself move on to the topic at hand. But Mike, you're more than welcome to stay on board with us while we delve into the topical issue that we want to discuss in a moment. Mike, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say two things, really. What Tim was just saying there is I've experienced firsthand. I went to high school in Penang in Malaysia, which is now a Muslim country, they say multicultural one. And you can see the difference there. The Chinese and the Indians live in nice houses. The Indians do most of the dirty work. The Chinese own all the business. And the Malays live in nasty little villages, what they call kampongs, which, they're pretty nasty, awful places to live. And the Muslims treat their women badly. They only get the government jobs because the government, the Muslim government, changed the laws to make it so that they have Muslims in every area of business and government. But if they hadn't done that, they would just still be sitting under the coconut trees. But Tim also brought up another point there. Here in Australia, mm-hmm. there is a pushback already. We have a new government in power, and I'm very, very pleased to see that they are pushing back. They're pushing the boat to Indonesia. They've even bought some new lifeboats so that when the illegal invaders sink their own boats, they just stick them into one of these boats and tow them back to Indonesia and say, get out, don't come back. So
Tim and I, we were discussing that Mike, that is brilliant, and that's something else I wanted to bring that up with you on your show last Wednesday. Please, can we touch on that on your show this Wednesday? That
I will.
Is something else. Absolutely. But, Mike, what I want you to do is I don't want you to hang up. I want to keep you here because this affects the Western world. What we're discussing tonight is about refugee status. And Tim and myself, we were discussing a brilliant article by Daniel Pipes from the Middle East Forum in that there is an allowance being made in that the West is being obligated to take in Syrian refugees in particular in this particular article from Daniel Pipes. And I was asking Tim, I was saying, like, well, what do we do? Like, when they get here, what do we do with them? How will they assimilate? And there is a real issue about that. And there's about one-tenth of Syria's 22 million residents that have fled across the international borders, mostly to neighboring Lebanon, Jordan, and Turkey. Now, these governments, they're unable to cope. They are restricting entry. They're prompting international concern about the Syrians' plight, quote-unquote, air quotes, hello. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Antonio Guterres, suggests that his agency look to resettle tens of thousands of Syrian refugees in countries better able to afford to host them. And that's recalling the post-2003 Iraqi resettlement program when 100,000 Iraqis resettled in the West. And others also look instinctively to the West for a solution. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, for example, had called on Western states to do more for Syrian refugees. Now, the appeal has been heard. Canada has offered to take in 1,300 Syrian refugees, the United States 2,000. Italy has received 4,600 Syrian refugees by sea. Germany has offered to take in, and they are continuing to receive, 5,000 Syrian refugees. Sweden has offered asylum to 15,000 Syrians that are already in that country. Local groups are preparing for a substantial influx throughout the West. These numbers pale, though, beside a population numbering in the millions, meaning that the West alone cannot solve the Syrian refugee problem. Further, in many Western countries, especially European ones such as the Netherlands and Switzerland, have wearied of taking in Muslim people who do not assimilate but instead seek to replace Western Moors with the Islamic law code, the Sharia. Both German Chancellor Angela Merkel and British Prime Minister David Cameron have deemed multiculturalism, with its insistence on the equal value of all civilizations, a failure. Worse, fascist movements such as the Golden Dawn in Greece are growing. And for those of you who are not familiar with the Golden Dawn, that is a political party in Greece that is very outspoken and very anti-immigrant. And the reason behind that, of course, is because of the growing Muslim influence. There are many more Muslim refugees that are likely on their way. In addition to Syrians, these include Bangladeshis, Pakistanis, Afghanis, Iranians, Iraqis, Lebanese, Palestinians, Egyptians, Somalis, and Algerians. Other nationals, for example, Yemenis and Tunisians. They also may join the ring. Now, there may be a solution at hand, and this is Daniel Pipe's solution. To place Syrians in countries better able to afford to host them, as Guterres delicately puts it, one needs simply divert attention from the Christian majority West towards the vast empty expanses of the fabulously wealthy kingdom of Saudi Arabia, as well as the smaller, but in some cases even richer states of Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates. For starters, these countries are much more convenient to repatriate these Syrians from, say, New Zealand. Now, living there means not enduring frozen climes, such as in Sweden, or learning a difficult language spoken by few, such as Danish. So why not resettle these people in their own cultural climes? Yeah. There is something else here. There is something much more important as well. Muslims of Arabia share deep religious ties with their Syrian brothers and sisters. So settling there avoids the strain of life in the West. Consider some of the harem, or forbidden, elements that Muslim refugees avoid by living in Arabia. Pet dogs. We have 61 million pet dogs in the United States. What about a pork-infused cuisine and an alcohol-soaked social life? And now, of course, Daniel Pipes is getting a tongue-in-cheek here. What about state-sponsored lotteries and Las Vegas-style gambling emporia? In modestly dressed women, ballet, swimsuit, beauty contests, single woman, living alone, mixed bathing, dating, and lawful prostitution, lesbian bars, homosexual pride parades, and gay marriage, a lax attitude towards hallucinogens with some drugs legal in certain jurisdictions, blasphemous novels, anti-Quran politicians, organizations of apostate Muslims, and a pastor who repeatedly and publicly burns Korans. And, of course, we know who that pastor is. That'll come to me in a moment. I'm just reading down the article. Again, I'm nearly done it, gentlemen. And, of course, Muslims living in Arabia, they could rejoice in a law code that, unlike Ireland, for example, that permits polygamy, and unlike Britain, that allows child marriages. Ireland does not permit polygamy. Britain does not allow child marriages. Unlike France, Arabia allows the advocacy of wife beating and goes easy on female genital mutilation. Unlike the United States, slaveholding does not entail imprisonment, and male relatives can honor kill their womenfolk without fear of the death penalty. So these examples of Syrians in Arabia suggest a far broader point. Regardless of affluence, refugees should be allowed and encouraged to remain within their own cultural zone, where they most readily fit in and stay true to their traditions, least disrupt the host society, and from whence they might most easily return home. Thus, East Asians should generally resettle in East Asia, Middle Easterners in the Middle East, Africans in Africa, Westerners in the West. And I was thinking of Terry Jones, Pastor Terry Jones, when he was the articleist was referring the pastor burning Korans. That was Pastor Terry Jones from Florida. And I want to thank Daniel Pipes for this article. And Tim, it's over to you.
Well, yeah, this is actually like many good ideas. It's a very simple one. Whenever there's a humanitarian crisis of this nature in the Middle East, liberal organizations in Western countries, they're first up to the microphone to say, let's take some refugees into Western countries. You know, we can give them a much better life here than they could have over in their host countries, especially when their host countries are racked by civil war or famine or any number of disasters, both natural and man-made. And they do this because the liberals, organizations I refer to, they do this because it makes them feel good. That's the way that liberals work in the West. They don't use reason, logic, and critical analysis. They do what makes them feel good. And they think, wouldn't it be lovely to invite all these people over here? After all, we have so much and they have so little. But what they fail to realize is that the sheer numbers, I mean, and this is a perfect example when you talk about Syria, the sheer numbers of people involved in particular with Syria, where there are 22 million people and 10% of them, that's 2.2 million, have fled across the international borders. If the proposal is that we take, let's say we wanted to solve this problem totally, so we had to resettle 2.2 million people. Well, even if you distributed them evenly amongst Western countries according to percentages of population, say, you're still talking about a huge, huge operation that would disrupt the infrastructure to an unacceptable, well, when I say unacceptable degree, the infrastructure in most Western countries is creaking at the edges anyway because of decades of underinvestment and over too many immigrants in the past 20 or 30 years that have made the infrastructure creak at the seams to start with. And if you suddenly take tens of thousands of Syrian immigrants and try and resettle them in Western countries, you're not only adding to the existing strains on the infrastructure, you're also introducing a lot of other problems, not the least of which is what is going to happen to these people when you want them to assimilate and integrate. Are you just going to keep them in the Western countries until things quieten down and get back to normal in Syria? Or are they going to be here for maybe one, two, three generations, effectively becoming British citizens or European citizens or American citizens or Australian citizens? I'm sure that the likelihood is that once they're over here, they're going to, if they can, they're going to try and stay over here because we're fairly generous with our benefits, and we can certainly provide a much more hospitable environment than pretty much any Islamic country you care to mention. Well, if we had an infinite amount of resources, okay, that might be reasonable. But if you're talking about resettling 2.2 million people, and that's just this crisis in Syria, and that crisis, I'm sure, is not going to be the last one in the Middle East,
yeah,
or anywhere else in the world. It makes far more sense, as Daniel Pipe says, to resettle them in not only closer to home, where they might feel a little happier about not having to accept Western cultural norms. If they're resettled closer to home, then if things do get better in their home country, it's a much easier proposition to help them to help them back there and let them rebuild their lives in their own country. But there's also other factors as well. If, for example, you've got, I don't know, say £100, and you can donate that and you can help a Syrian make a start in a new life in a neighbouring Middle East country. Now, you take that same Syrian and you ship him over to the United States and you try and make him feel home in the United States, it wouldn't cost you £100 or $100 or whatever the nominal sum is. It will probably cost you 100 times that amount at the very least. You'd be looking at $10,000 or £10,000 to even start to resettle that person in a completely new environment and make them feel at home. Just imagine all the things that you've got to do for them. The fact, just in monetary terms alone, it would make more sense to try and help people. And to be fair, I think that as wealthy countries that we are in the West, I think when there are these humanitarian crises that come up from time to time, whether they're natural disasters or man-made disasters, It is right that we do what we can to help, but our money is far more effectively spent providing we can provide the appropriate oversight to make sure it's not stolen by corrupt officials in those countries. Our money is much more effectively spent providing it much closer to where that refugee lives. All right, he might not be able to live in his own country for a little while, but the neighbouring countries, if they are struggling, we should be sending humanitarian aid to those countries, have it properly overseen so that it doesn't get stolen like so much overseas aid gets stolen these days by corrupt officials. And we should be trying to make those people comfortable in those countries. And as Daniel Pipe says, when you talk about the Middle East in particular, and you're looking at the massive wealth of Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Dubai, United Arab Emirates, and so on, they are far better placed to absorb those refugees than we are. And all right, they're fabulously wealthy. That doesn't mean that we can't send over some money to help that resettlement take place. But when
we've got to settle. You know, Tim, we have to settle them somewhere. They're living in these camps. I mean, there are camps. For example, in Jordan cannot contain these refugees any longer. They're pleading with the United Nations, get these people off our hands. They're draining our system, and that is also an issue. Fine, Canada, Australia, the United Kingdom, the United States, they have agreed to take in these refugees, but how do we deal with them in our own economic hard times. And I want to ask, I'm going to take a break in a moment, but I want Mike to say something about this and what Australia is dealing with in terms of these refugees. Mike?
Well, up until the last election, we had the Greens and Labor in here, and they were just opening our borders. But the new government has shut the borders, and they're now towing back the boats. But I don't think this is going to solve the problem. The real problem is that these people are fleeing their own countries and not doing anything to change things in their own countries. This is where they need to be. They need to be back there in their own place and fixing the problems. So the people who are fleeing, in my opinion, are just a bunch of cowards, and they don't deserve our help at all. Send them back and let them solve the problem. If they've got these Islamist killers amongst them, get rid of them. Fight them. This is what we're doing in Australia. We will not allow it to happen here. Why aren't they doing it back there? That's all I have to
say. Exactly. I'm going to take a bit of a break, but when we come back, Mike, can you stay with Tim and myself? Because I do have a twofold part to this topic. I have a couple of shout-outs I need to do, but we're going to be back in about 6 minutes, in that the second part I want to discuss, and Tim touched upon this, is that the when we take in these refugees, they bring the baggage with them and the trauma. I want to touch on that. And, Mike, when we come back, I want you to bring that up. How do we deal with the traumatized refugee? But for now, there is something I really do need to do. And as ladies and gentlemen, you know, I am part of the Jewish Defense League of Canada. And there is a rally going on tomorrow afternoon at noontime. That is Tuesday, January 14th. You can join the Jewish Defense League as they protest, as we protest, remarks made by CBC host Evan Solomon regarding Canada's new ambassador to Israel, Vivian Berkasivi. The rally will take place at 250 Front Street, West Toronto. Like I say, Canadian Broadcasting Company, CBC, anchor Evan Solomon, he sparked outrage in questioning the appointment of Vivian as Canada's new ambassador to Israel due to her being Jewish. Solomon's comments came during a live interview with Foreign Affairs Minister John Baird last Thursday. In the interview, mere hours after Berkasivi was appointed to her new post, Solomon said to Baird, "Vivian is Jewish, so there are going to be some questions. Why not appoint someone who doesn't even have the perception of any kind of bias in favor of Israel?" That, to me personally, I find assaultive. I think that this person should be fired, and I think that the rally, ladies and gentlemen, please share this information. I'm going to play a clip for you right now about this.
Why not appoint someone from the diplomatic corps? I mean, obviously, this is a very sensitive position. I mean, Vivian Berkovich is Jewish, so there are going to be some questions. Why not appoint someone who doesn't even have the perception of any kind of bias?
Well, Evan, I didn't ask what religion she was. I didn't ask.
But you must have done your research. I mean,
her name looks Italian. No, in fact, before we offered the position, I, in fact, personally did not know she was Jewish. That's not the way our government runs things. We look for people who are talented and capable and who can do the job.
Not so many questions about who Canada appointed as our new ambassador to Israel, but more question about how the CBC's Evan Solomon handled his interview with Canada's Foreign Affairs Minister, John Baird, who made the announcement yesterday that Vivian Bonavich would be our new ambassador. And I think, and Michael Diamond is our Sunday contributor who's been following this. I got her last name incorrect. Berkovich. Thank you. So we just showed everybody at home the clip of Evan Solomon on CBC last night with on his show, Power and Politics, with Foreign Affairs Minister John Baird. And he was confronting the minister and questioning the, not only the background of her and her previous experience. He points out that she has written very strong views on the Palestinian Authority. She's a journalist. She is not someone that was selected from the diplomatic corps, which is usually the case in this instance when you are picking an ambassador, for example. But really, when you read the whole transcript of what Solomon had to say to Baird, it's a very questionable line of attack.
Well, you know, absolutely. Question comments she's made in the past, question things she said, but to say that, you know, based on her religion, how did the minister not know? Well, as he correctly pointed out, it's illegal in this country to even ask someone mm-hmm. such a thing in an application or job process. He didn't do his research. Well, why would he care? I mean, this is Canada. We're beyond that. It's a great country precisely because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's no surprise conservatives don't really believe in affirmative action. This isn't, they weren't going out, they were selecting an ambassador, not selecting a demographic.
Yeah, so I just want to read another bit from the transcript between Solomon and Foreign Affairs Minister John Baird. He questioned her. Solomon said to Baird, you must have done your research. And then that's when we showed everybody home. Baird said, her name looks Italian. But then Solomon wouldn't let it go. He kept on, I get that you don't want to do religious questioning on people, but are you being serious or are you being disingenuous that you didn't know about her religious background when you point someone to a sensitive position like this?
And that's the most bizarre part to me, that Evan Solomon just couldn't fathom the idea that John Baird just wouldn't care when making an appointment, such an important appointment into the Foreign Service. There was also a comment earlier in the interview of the perception of bias. Well, mm-hmm. why does she have the perception of bias? Because of her religion.
Now, what do we know about the new ambassador?
So she has lived in the region. She has lived in Israel, been a lawyer. She served as an advisor in the Harris government at Queen's Park. So, you know, she's not from the Foreign Service. Mm-hmm. She's not a diplomat by trade, but some of her most important diplomatic posts never are, you know, Washington, London,
mm-hmm.
and Israel under the Harper government has become an increasingly important partner. So mm-hmm. I think that makes perfect sense.
And they also brought up the fact that the Prime Minister will be traveling to Israel and Ramallah very soon, and even trying to tie that in with this appointment, which is a bit of a stretch, I think.
Well, you know, absolutely. And no one's ever questioned the ability of the ambassadors from the United Kingdom or the United States to Israel to do their job without a perception of bias. They're both happen to be Jewish, not that that's relevant to anything, but it just, you know, was such a bizarre line of questioning. It's an outdated way of thinking, and we should have expected more, I think, from the CBC.
Yeah, I think that there is a lot more questions that should be asked towards the CBC, but you flagged this for us. You've been following this out in the ether of social media. Are there many people questioning Solomon's interview with the minister, or is everyone sort of brushing this aside and not really delving into this really heated notion of what appeared to be anti-Semitic?
Well, you know, at the time of the interview, there was quite a bit of, not quite a bit, but it's all relative when we're talking about anything political, but mm-hmm. of Twitter traffic. There were several people who jumped in and pointed out that this is an offensive line of questioning, that the minister is correct, that it's not a relevant issue. And I was personally impressed by Evan Solomon's ability to interview and tweet at the same time and respond personally. But, it was just, there was a bit of an outroar, and I think we'll probably see more of this in the day ahead.
Yeah, it's actually pretty fascinating when some more traction on this one goes. Well, we'll see if there's any crawlback from some of the comments. But we'll have to leave it there, unfortunately. Time is our enemy. Michael Diamond, he is our Sun News contributor, and join me in our Toronto studio.
And I'm not the only one who messed up her name. Vivian Berkovich is her name. She is the new ambassador to Israel. And Evan Solomon had quite a few disparaging things to say about that appointment. So thus, the Jewish Defense League of Canada, they have a rally tomorrow at noon. That will take place at 250 Front Street West, Toronto, in front of the CBC headquarters. So if you folks can get the word out, get there and fight anti-Semitism. This is absolutely disgraceful. I also have another public announcement. I'm bringing Tim and Mike back on in a moment, but there are some public announcements that I need to share with you. There is another one I want to relate to you, and that regards the American pastor Syed Abedini. He may be seeing freedom quite soon. In the United States, Senator Ted Cruz, he's a stalwart advocate for American pastor Syed Abedini's freedom. Syed Abedini is an apostate. He's a Christian now, and he went over to Iran to build an orphanage, and he has been sentenced to what is looking like an 8-year prison sentence. This man is not getting medical care. His wife, Negma, and his 2 young children desperately want him back home in the United States. Senator Ted Cruz totally denigrated Barack Hussein Obama in his agreement with Iran in their enrichment deal, the deal heard around the world. Senator Ted Cruz had this to say: "It is unconscionable that senior American diplomats, including the Secretary of State, which of course is John Kerry, who were conducting cordial negotiations with their Iranian counterparts in Geneva in the days after Pastor Saeed's transfer, could not bring themselves to even mention his name or those of fellow Americans detained in Iran, and that includes Amir Hikmati and Robert Levinson. He noted how the Obama administration's inaction at a crucial time is leading to disastrous results for Pastor Saeed and others wrongly detained. He explained, "We are informed by administration officials that the issue of the American prisoners is on the margins of more important diplomatic work, and that in any event, President Obama mentioned Abedini and Hermati to Iranian President Hassan Rouhani when they spoke by telephone in September. The president's actions should not have been an end unto itself, but rather the first step in a sustained effort to get these men home. Their unconditional release should be central, not peripheral, to any further agreement with Iran. If the United States was prepared to release an Iranian nuclear scientist, Mojibah Atarodi, my apologies, as a good faith gesture, paving the way to direct negotiations between our two nations for the first time in more than 30 years, the Iranians should have been required to do at least as much. Pastor Saeed and others are being held in Iranian prisons for being nothing more than Christians." I want you to take a listen to this.
"1 year. American pastor Syed Abedini, a U.S. citizen, is approaching 1 year inside the walls of Iran's most brutal prison. 1 year apart from his wife and children who wait for him at home in Boise, Idaho. Syed was sentenced to 8 years in prison simply for his Christian faith. Since then, over 615,000 of you have signed a petition on his behalf. The White House and the Secretary of State called for his immediate release, and his cause was heard at the United Nations. Now it's time for the next step in this journey to help save Syed. In August of 2013, a new president took power in Iran. He vowed to be more moderate than Ahmadinejad. Today, we are launching a letter-writing campaign directly to the new Iranian president with a simple and respectful request: release Pastor Syed. Locked inside the walls of Evin Prison, Pastor Syed cannot speak for himself. But you can speak for Pastor Syed. Join our nonpartisan, non-political effort to seek justice for those who are oppressed and persecuted. Be heard. Please speak for Syed Abedini. This is the most important step that we have taken so far. Go to BeHeardProject.org and sign your name to a letter to the new president of Iran. We will print it and mail it for you on behalf of Syed. We can make a difference with your help. Let your voice be heard. Thank you for your support."
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for allowing me to to share all of this information. We have had quite, for a, hey Mike and Tim, it's quite for a Monday. It's quite the something. But these are very, very important messages that I had to convey to our listeners. These are very important. Please try to spread. If you're in the Toronto area, please try to be at the Jewish Defense League rally tomorrow. And please pray for Pastor Saeed Abedini and ensure his homecoming and that he returns to the bosom of his family safe and sound. Now, we are moving into the second part of the topic that we have been discussing tonight, and that is refugees and how to settle them and how they how will they assimilate. And Mike, I was asking you to take the helm about this. And how do you feel, in particular, Syrian refugees? Mike, quite frankly, Syrian refugees, they kind of scare me. How do you think they would settle in Australia, for example?
Well, we have to differentiate. If they're Christian Syrians, I have no problem with letting them in because they come from the same basic culture as we do. I believe that we should save these people as much as possible. But if they are Muslims, I say absolutely no way because they will not try and settle in. They probably are radicalized already, and if they're not, they will be easily influenced to be. We have the example just recently, I think last year, of a Christian and a Muslim family living next to each other in Syria. And the imam came to the Muslim family and said, you have to kill the Christians next door. And the Muslim woman even said, oh, I don't want to do that. She, you know, we've lived next to them all our lives and they're our friends. And the Muslim pastor said, the imam said, you have to do it. And they did. So in other words, you cannot trust these people. And all it takes is for one imam to come along and say, kill, and they will. So as I said, you know, you've got to be very careful who you let in. It's the same as when you open the front door of your house. You don't just let everybody in. You are careful who you let in.
I think that what you say is totally reasonable, Mike, in that... I'm going to get Tim on here in a moment, but I want to share my own opinion, of course, and that is there is a very much a lack of assimilation in my personal opinion because they are, as Daniel Pipes explained in the article, that they are, well, first of all, they're traumatized by war and everything else, but they are also rooted in a belief system that is totally incompatible with the West. When they come here because they can manipulate and malleabate the host country in that I can get my benefits and I can get this and I can get that. And it may be a little on the cold side sometimes, but at least I get a winter coat to keep warm when I go outside. But they, in their mind's eye, they really do see us as infidels. These are Muslims that we're dealing with. And Tim, what do you think about that? Oh, did I lose Tim?
Sorry, that was my fault. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now.
Okay.
What do you think
that
about that? It's the mindset that they bring with them, the trauma.
Yes, indeed. I mean, this has been the problem all along, is that immigrants from Muslim countries bring that mindset with them. And the vast majority retain that mindset to the detriment of the indigenous population when it comes to integration and assimilation. We've found that there's been a problem for the last 20 or 30 years. And, of course, when it was first noticed, our political elites and our mainstream media said to to us in their wisdom, well, it's all the fault of you as the indigenous population. You're not welcoming enough. You're racist. You're Islamophobic. And you have to try harder. And we have to give them more money and bigger houses for their ever-increasing families. And we have to put them at the top of the queue for everything that's going in the way of welfare handouts, so that it will add to the much vaunted community cohesion that never seems to materialize no matter how much we give. And of course, that problem hasn't been solved, and it never will be solved with the existing attitudes that we have with our political elites and our mainstream media. And if we add to that problem with additional immigrants, whether or not they're refugees from foreign countries or whether they immigrate through other means, if we don't solve the problem, we are just opening up a huge hole for ourselves that is eventually going to swallow us all up.
Oh, exactly. And you know what? We have two other fine gentlemen joining us, and that's Tommy English and Jeff Mitchell, and both of them of EDL Radio. And Jeff has been listening very closely to the conversation. And Jeff, when you and by the way, Jeff, welcome. Hi, honey.
Thank you, Carol. Thank you. It's
when
been very
when you listen, when oh, it is, isn't it? When you read these stories about resettlement, and you are living, you and Tommy, and Tommy's going to come on in a moment, but Jeff in particular with you, when you and Tim, and of course Mike. When you hear about these resettlement programs and what you see in your own countries, just tell me what it's like when you walk into a neighborhood where it's turned into an enclave. Tell us about the Sharia no-go zones.
Well, you know, the way to look at it is really the person who should be telling exactly how it is, and that's our very own Mr. Tommy English. I mean, I'm quite lucky where I live that I don't have that situation, apart from when you go into the main part of Ipswich, which is just over the last few years has become more Muslim, you know, more Muslims here, more halal butchers up and around and that. Tommy English is the right person to ask that question to, because he lives it, he breathes it, he's been brought up. He's seen his whole the side of where he lives has been changed since he's been around. He's seen it. He's been through the system.
Yeah.
What we talk about. But one thing I wanted to say, as I say, because Tommy's probably a better person to answer because he's on the ground, so he knows exactly what it's like, and he's been the right person to share his thoughts and his views with your listeners out there. But it's good to be it's good to call in on the show this evening. I just want to say that some of the things that you've been talking about, I think of the way that we accommodate these people, the way that really pisses me off. I've got to say it, Kel. It annoys me so much. Mm-hmm. Is what David Cameron said a while ago. We got to speak out. What he said, that we should not. They should. The Muslims, when they come here, they shouldn't have to worry about adapting to us. But we, the indigenous people of our country, must adapt to them. So there's something wrong when our British Prime Minister says that. It just goes to show you. The dimitude that we've got with our politicians, the cowardice, the weakness, in case they offend the Muslims. They don't want them to go rioting on the streets and this and that if they raise these points. But we do, because we see it. We see it on a daily basis. And as I said, Tommy is the person to really speak out about it. You know, we've been boot towns at Birmingham, places like that, Tim will tell you,
mm-hmm.
certain parts of Birmingham, you really don't want to go in after dark. It's so dangerous a place to be. And I think Tim would echo my statement there.
I totally agree with you, and that I want Tommy to address that. And Tommy is joining us right now. And, of course, ladies and gentlemen, we are discussing the issue of refugee resettlement and how much allowances should we get them, how much is too much, can the host countries assimilate those of trauma and economic dire need. We have joining us tonight, of course, along with Tim and myself, we have Mike Holt of Restore Australia, Jeff Mitchell of EDL Radio, and Tommy English of EDL Radio. And Tommy, I would like to ask you, and Tommy, hi Tommy.
Hello.
I would like to, Jeff has alluded that you are living on claims. When we bring in these refugees, and they set up shop and they create enclaves? And Jeff has said that you're living it. What do you see, Tommy?
Well, what I can see is, you know, when I was growing up in my estate of Hull, it was this big, big Jewish estate. Basically, they used to have hundreds and hundreds of Jewish people. I mean, they were so nice. They're such caring people, the Jewish people. And, of course, when Serbia and Bosnia went to war, and the British government said, oh, we're letting all these Bosnian Muslim refugees. And, of course, one of the places that they was going to send them was Hull. And basically, when the first couple of hundred came out of nowhere, they battered an eyelid until, of course, about 1999, until they said, right, we want to build a mosque right round the corner from Hull's main synagogue. And, of course, the Jewish community were proper scared about that, and they were so, so scared. So they wrote an open letter to the local council in the Hull Daily Mail saying, if you build this mosque near our synagogue, they'll attack us, they'll burn it down, they'll try and kill us in our houses. And the local government said, not to worry, we'll sort out this problem. So they let them build this mosque.
Good grief.
Exactly.
So much for assimilation.
Exactly. So they let them build this mosque, our mega mosque, and then they moved the synagogue 50 miles outside of Hull.
To accommodate the Muslims, that's what Tommy's saying.
Yeah.
To accommodate the Muslims, they thought they'd move the Jewish community who's been there for many years, and it was them that had to move to accommodate the Muslims, and that's what we find. As I say, Tommy will say, even like if Tommy, and he's proud to be who he is, he's the EDL, he's a part of the English Defence League, if he puts on his hoodie, you know, his EDL hoodie, which he's very proud to wear. Tommy, share what happens when you walk down the street and you're wearing your hoodie. You're proud to wear it, aren't you, son?
I'm wearing it right now.
There you go. Go on, Tommy.
When are you not wearing it?
He goes to bed in it. He's got pajamas.
Jeff is right on to something, and I recall that you were speaking about this. And Jeff, thank you so very much for jogging my memory about that. That Tommy, you were wearing your EDL hoodie. What happened to you when you walked into an enclave?
I get about 30 of them following me. They're on the mobile phones. You get the cars pulling up, and it's me who gets thrown in the nick for causing religiously aggravated tension.
And this is because he's a patriot, because he loves his country. This is the trouble, and Tim will say that, and probably Mike would agree.
Well,
because you're a patriot now, it's a dirty word. You call yourself a patriot now, and Tommy will say, in the eyes of the establishment and those in power, it's a dirty word. You know, we got to feel guilty because of our past.
Guys, I was on my way to
that
work. Before. Happened again.
One at a time.
Sorry,
I don't know, there's such a delay here because I'm calling off the phone, but what I was going to say, it did happen to me today. There was about 10 or 15 of them following me, so I was just walking down the street at 6:30 in the morning, shouting, I'm proud to be an Englishman, and I'm going to
at
be
At least
free.
I know I'm free.
Forget the man who died who gave
I really do want to concentrate on this issue, though. I mean, we are making a lot of allowances when it comes to refugees entering our Western host countries. And I want to ask Mike a question in particular. Mike, you have a new prime minister, and he is turning the boats away. What is going on with that? What's his name? Who is this new prime minister, and what is he doing when it comes to these refugees showing up on the Australian shores?
Okay, well, Tony Abbott is his name, and he's an ex-Jesuit. He was studying to become a Jesuit priest. So he's a little bit of... he's very Christian, very Catholic. But he's appointed some very good people, Christian Bernardi. Christopher Pine is now reviewing the education system with a view of getting rid of all the socialist crap that they've been putting in.
Mm-hmm.
Scott Morrison is our new immigration minister, and he's the guy that's getting rid of the boats and pushing them back. And the policy of this government is not to say anything about their activities and what they're, you know, how they're doing this and why. And, of course, the Greens and the Labour, socialist Labourites are screaming blue murder. Why aren't you? You have to tell us what's going on. No, we don't. This is national security, and we have to do this. Now, I've got a very disturbing little piece of news to tell you this morning. I don't know if I've mentioned it, but I woke up this morning and my wife went outside the front door and somebody had egged the front of our house. Now, I don't know.
I don't know how
to this stage, but I'm taking it very seriously in view of the fact that I've been getting death threats. So we are moving. We're going to be moving house very quickly. We're looking for another place now, and we will not be making our new address public because
I don't want to drive you out, Mike. That's what they want.
Well, that's fine.
That's it exactly, and that really distresses me, Mike, because you and I, being colleagues, in that we information share, and I share pictures from my garden, and I've seen pictures from your garden. You have a beautiful, beautiful home, in that you feel that they're driving you out of it. That really very much distresses me, and this brings up something that I was relating to Jeff and Tommy on their program, EDL East Anglian EDL Radio Show, in that there was an elderly lady. She had lived in her marriage home for 60 years, and the Muslims came along, and they intimidated her out of living there. She was forced to sell her marriage home, 60 years. And she was forced to move out because she could not take the harassment any longer. This is bringing us right back to a full circle in the topic at hand tonight, and that is let the refugees remain in their own cultures. Why do we have to take in particular, the Syrians that we are discussing tonight? Why do we have to do this? Why cannot Saudi Arabia or the neighboring peninsulas take them in? And Tim, I have a question for you, and that is, how do we tell our governments that we can't take the overload? It's too much. The trauma, the psychological trauma of these refugees coming into our countries, and the economic expense that we have to endure. Tim, how are we to convince our sitting governments that, no, we can't do it anymore? Tim, I'll narrow it down right now. Do we get out of the United Nations? Because the United Nations is behind all of this.
Well, the United Nations is certainly part of the problem rather than part of the solution. I think what's more important is that we get out of the European Union, which is controlling a great deal of our domestic politics, probably to a far greater extent than the United Nations itself is. I mean, the United Nations might say, okay, Europe can take, I don't know, 100,000 of these refugees or whatever. If the EU were to agree to that, the EU would then say, right, okay, France takes so many, Germany takes so many, and so on. And because the EU is an unelected body with far too much power and control over the nations that belong to it, it's quite difficult for us as we used to be a sovereign country at one time, and we could have just said, no, we're not having any of this. But while we're part of the EU, that's actually quite difficult for us. I think rather than concentrate on getting out of the United Nations, I think we should concentrate on getting out of the European Union. Once we once we've taken that as a first step, then yes, there may well be other institutions, related institutions, that are fettering us, where we have to cast off the shackles. But the European Union is far and away the first target, because it's got far too much power, and it has the ability, the way it's currently structured, to totally cripple our country by introducing, amongst other things, large numbers of people who are virtually unassimilable and unintegratable. And if it were only a, you know, 100 or 200, maybe that would be a different matter. But I'm sure whatever figure they pick on to try and force us to take to start with, that will only be the tip of the iceberg, and the argument will then be used, well, last year you took 1,000, so maybe this year you can take 10,000. Now, don't say you can't, because you took 1,000 in and the country didn't fall apart, so this year you can have 10 times as many, and and maybe the year after that you can have twice as many as that again. And there'll be very little, if while we're still in the European Union, there'll be very little we can do about it. We need, first of all, to reclaim our...
We need to sever our ties with it, totally.
We do.
We are a little island. We're not, you know, a massive, great, big country. We are a little island, and we have accommodated as much people as we possibly can. We're under all sorts of pressure. The fabrication of the country, the hospitals, the schools, everything. I mean, in 10 years' time, the way it's going, this will be like a banana republic. Let's be honest, guys. This is the way they're pushing us towards something like that, and it's going to be sad. My great country, Great Britain, will not be great anymore. That's how dire the situation is. We have to sever our ties with the Europeans, the European Union.
Hit something right on you hit the nail on the head right there, as did Tim. Getting out of the European Union and getting out of the United Nations. And we have quite a chat room going on here, and Agador is in the United States, and he is for getting out of the United Nations for sure. And Tim? We have some guests here, Agador, Christian Chicanering, Dodgy Dave, Mike Holt, Jeff Mitchell, Tommy English, Sue from New Mexico, my sweetie, and Terry was staying on the line. So we want to thank all of you guys for listening, and we want to thank all of you that also listen in archive at a later date. But, yeah, Jeff, you really touched on something there. And that is, Tim touched on it too. Why is it that... Okay, you know what? We're down to about 25 minutes of talking points. But one thing that
I'll talk fast.
Jeff triggered and Tim triggered, how do we... And actually, I'm going to ask this question. Oh, and Vorpabite just walked in. Hi, Vorp. I'm going to ask this question, and I want Mike to address it first and foremost, and then I want Tim to address it, then I want you, Jeff, to address it, and then I want you, Tommy, to address it. Okay, here's the question. How do we stop foreign entities from dictating our domestic policy, and in particular, how we are obligated to take in refugees? Mike?
Well, every country faces a slightly different problem, but here in Australia we're very lucky because we have a constitution, unlike the UK, and unfortunately that constitution has become outmoded, but my group, Restore Australia, is dedicated to constitutional reform, And to do that, we've even gone so far as to write a whole new draft constitution. In that, we propose cutting all, stopping all UN and other treaties and reviewing them and renegotiating them from a position of strength. So if we did become a sovereign nation, which we're not now, we're beholden to the UN, and this is why we've had this this so-called immigration problem. I call it an invasion problem. If we did bring in this new draft constitution, we could negotiate as a nation of Australians, not as we used to be a British colony, and actually, in actual fact, we still are, despite the changes to the constitution that have been made over the years. In actual fact, we are still a British colony. Just the form has changed. So this is our approach. We get rid of the treaties and renegotiate them, and from there, we can build up a defence policy and change the way that our nations are governed. And this is something that has to be done, I think, in all of our nations. We can see here in the UK and in Canada and the US, Australia, we have a two-party system, and it's the system that is the problem. So we're addressing that problem here in Australia. So what is going on over in the UK, for instance?
That, Mike, I really enjoy your Wednesday program. Well, it's Wednesday afternoon for me. It's Thursday morning for you, in that you do discuss the issue of establishing a new constitution. I am so appreciative of that. I wish Canada had the balls to do the same, because our constitution is a bit of a mess. And Mike, I really want to have a private conversation with you about that later on, because I think that we might have a very good topic down the road regarding that. But Tim, the issue of foreign entities interfering with our domestic policy, what do you think?
Yes, well, it's obviously a huge problem, and as Mike said, in Australia, they're quite lucky in a way, in so much as they have a constitution which is going to be more easily fixable than what we have here in the UK at the moment. At the moment, we've got a kind of sticking plaster type constitution, as somebody might once referred to it not too long ago, based as it is on the Magna Carta of 1215 and the Bill of Rights of 1689, with loads and loads of laws that have been added since then and adhered through I won't say custom and practice, because it's a bit more involved than that, we've got a whole patchwork which is made up, which gives us what we have today in place of a well thought out constitution. I mean, Mike's alluded to the constitution that he would like to see in Australia, and it's taken 100 people or thereabouts 12 years in order to draft that, so that's 1,200 man years to actually draft a constitution for Australia, and I'm quite sure it would take at least that amount of time to draft a similar constitution for us, and we'd have to more or less start from scratch, because to my knowledge, nobody has taken that course of action to even start producing something suitable. I mean, I may be wrong, and if I am wrong, I'm very happy to be corrected. If somebody wants to post a link in the chat room, there may well be people who discuss the implications of the constitution. I know there's a website called the British Constitution Group that discusses the various implications.
Yes, I've heard of that.
That's a cry from saying here's a constitution which could replace exactly what we have in the UK. But without that sort of constitution, it then becomes very difficult to extract ourselves from the mess we've currently got ourselves into with the European Union. And that, as I said in my previous comment, that's the very first thing we've got to do when we get a government in power. Once we get a government in power that's got some common sense and some political will, that's the very first thing we've got to do. We've got to get out of the European Union. We've got to repeal the Human Rights aspect and
go back to the
pretty
basics,
much,
then, basically.
Pretty much everything else that has been forced on us over the past 30 or 40 years since we first entered what was then, I think, the EEC at the time we entered it, and has since morphed into this uncontrollable monster which threatens to absorb us as part of a federal Europe. And we have to get out of that. There's no question that we're going to find everything else really, really hard to do unless we do that first. How do we do it? Well, that's the very first thing. But once we've got a government in place with the political will to take that step, then I think we'll find that an awful lot of other things will become progressively easier.
Tim, once again, you have summed it up perfectly. Mike and Tim, you have summed it up. And Jeff, I want to ask your opinion. What do you think we should do about foreign entities interfering with our domestic policy?
Well, I would say that I was listening to Mike Holt with the building a new constitution in Australia, maybe that's something we should seriously be thinking about in this country. We haven't got as Tim says, we haven't got the political will at this moment in time with the politicians we got, but we need strong leadership and, you know, to be able to stand up and man up instead of wimping out like a lot of these politicians that we've got. I did like what I was listening to what Mike had to say about it, but also echoing the same thoughts as Tim on that issue, that we need that political stability to be able to go ahead and to do the things that we know that needs to be done. Until that time comes, then we're going to keep rolling down this path and we'll be continuing to talk about it. We need to be able to put people in power who will do what's right for the country, the nation, and nations, not just the UK, but, you know, countries like Australia, Canada, and all freedom-loving people. You know, that's where it should be built around. But otherwise, we're going down a very sticky path. And as Tim said many times, we could lead to all sorts of problems down the line if we do not do something now. The time for sitting and wagging fingers and this, that is over. Time for some constructive, things to be done now. Because, as I say, time is catching up. The demographics will go away. This will happen, and if we're not very careful. So, but once again, it was great to listen to what Mike had to say. It's great to listen to you, Mike, as well. What you had to say, and of course, Tim. So I echo both.
It's always a pleasure. It's always a pleasure to have my gentleman here with me. I want to address an issue that Tommy English can probably address better than me, in that Tommy, you're a very young lad, and you have been listening to the conversation regarding how do we keep foreign entities out of our domestic policy. Tommy, you're a young man. What do you see? You know what? I'm putting Tommy on the spot. I'm giving him a twofold question. First of all, he's a young man, and he's got many, many, many years ahead of him. But Tommy, what do you think we should do, and do you see anything foreseeable in the future in which that we can prevent foreign entities from interfering with domestic policy?
Well, I think the way you got to stop foreign entities from taking over domestic policies is to not let them in positions of authority. So it's like when you look at my northern part of the country, when you've got Muslim MPs, you've got chiefs of police who are Muslim, you've got head doctors who are Muslim, and basically when you look at them, they're not looking out for the interests of people like me, you, Jeff, Tim, Mike, the mainstream people. They're looking out for their people, and wherever there is a Muslim MP in this country, there's a rise of child sex gangs, FGM, crime. It's spiralling out of control. And it's not only that, when it comes to Islam, and you've got these massive, massive traitors like George Galloway and all that, who was it Bethnal Green that used to be a member of Parliament of? I think it was Bethnal Green.
It was the Labour Party, wasn't it, Tom?
I can't
oh,
remember.
Oh, no, it was the Respect Party. Respect Party, wasn't it? That's it.
Yeah, Mr. Respect Party.
Yeah, the Respect Party. Yeah.
Yeah, Mr. I will chuck eggs at the opposition from the top of a double-decker bus.
Yes.
That's a respectful isn't it? Well, yeah, basically, when you get these Muslims who are in very high positions of authority, that's when they get these clearings, and that's where you see the large surge of these Muslim populations, and that's when you see this increase in big crime. And basically, the way you've got to keep them out is just to make sure that everybody knows what they're going to do. So, I mean, obviously, when you've got that whole Sakia strategy, you know, like when you've got people like Mohammed Shafiq, who's the Muslim MP of Sheffield, I will keep all... I will stabilise the Muslim and non-Muslim relations. Well, I say it's for the past 5 years, it's gone down, and their child sex rape's gone up by 5%, and the crime's gone up by 15%. What does that tell you?
Oh, it says a way too. I'm speechless. It says way too much.
Well, if I wasn't doing it for you guys, the Muslim prison population's gone up 200% from 2006.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good point. And that is that's a worrying thing as well, because as we know from people who's been serving a bit of time there, especially Tommy Robinson, told us it's the Muslims that run the prisons. That's it.
Yeah.
That's what we expect.
Well,
yes.
They
convert
other guys. Exactly. Exactly. Yes. And yes, and Jeff, you brought up a really, really, really salient point when you brought up Tommy Robinson, that he was so harassed that they put him in solitary confinement because he was was in prison in a Muslim-run prison, and that is, you know, devastating. And we all know that that's the largest conversion center in the West. But, gentlemen, we are out of time. We are down to our last 5 minutes of talking points. And Tim and myself, though, we want to thank Mike and Jeff and Tommy for being here today. This is the very
indeed.
First time I've ever run a panel. This was rather exciting.
Yeah, very good. I've got to say, Kel, I've been very pleased to call in tonight and be a part of the panel tonight on your great show. And it was great to listen to Mr. Mike Holt as well, right? It's been a pleasure to listen to some of the things you've had to say.
Oh, and Jeff, make sure that you're here Wednesday evening, 8 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. Mike Holt of Restore Australia, his show will be airing right here on Red Fox Blogger.
Well, I will do my very utmost best, Mike, to be there. Look forward to listening. And if I do miss it by any chance, I will definitely be catching up with you in the archives, and that'll be dead. But once again,
no
thanks,
worries,
Jeff.
I send you all the shows. But, gentlemen,
you,
it has been...
I get them on Twitter from Sue.
Oh, God bless Sue. I love her. Oh, she is brilliant in that she's getting the shows out there for everybody. But it has been a wonderful evening. I really want to thank all you fine gentlemen. Tim and myself, we are always so grateful that people call in and they contribute and they have their share and their say in what's going on out there regarding the scourge. Ladies and gentlemen, Tim and myself, we were discussing, can the host countries assimilate those of trauma and economic dire need? And I think we tackled that topic quite handily, Tim.
If only we could have a solution. When we sum it up, Kel, we could have a solution. Right, that's it. We'll put this in place. It's just a shame that being a panelist, we can't put things in action to make it, you know, the things that we talk
Absolutely.
About, which should be done. It's just a shame that we haven't got that authority to do that, because I'm sure every single person that's taking part in the show tonight would do exactly that. I know Mike's working hard with the Constitution, changing some of the things in the Constitution in Australia. Good work, good luck with your work and your endeavours on that, Mike, and we'll be following very closely what you'll be doing in the future. God bless you, brother.
thank you, and thank you for having me on the show. And Kel, you are doing a marvelous job, and I want to thank you for giving me my radio show. But I'd just like to make a point before we go.
Always my pleasure.
Someone mentioned, well, what can we do? Well, I started out 3 years ago, and I met Charles Mollison, our chairman, and he was the guy that started the whole thing. He wrote the draft constitution over about 12 years with that 100 people. And it all starts with one person saying, I don't like this. It's time to change something. So don't lose faith over there in the UK and Canada and the US. We can all do something. It just takes one person to decide, I'm going to do something about it. And that one person then can get other people to do things, and eventually it spreads. And that's what's happening here in Australia. Restore Australia is gathering a lot of supporters, and I'm very proud to know many of them. They're great people because we all love our country, and we're all determined to make a difference. And that's all you have to do. Just decide you're going to make a difference.
Mike, thank you so very much. And we're going to see you back here on the airwaves Wednesday afternoons, 3 p.m., like I say, Eastern Standard Time, 8 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, 6 a.m. Australian Time. I might can figure that one out. But we are
about
so
1
totally done. And I want to thank, Tim and myself. Like, Tim is my co-host on the Monday afternoon program, and Tim, on behalf of Tim, oh, that would sound. But we really want to thank you.
What
guys,
you like, Kel.
Tommy, Jeff, Mike, you were brilliant, and I'm going to give Tim the last word, and he gets 1 minute to do that before we play out.
I've got 60 seconds.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. Well, thanks. Thank you very much, Kel. Okay, well, just to summarise, I think the most humane thing all round when it comes to refugees, whether it's from Syria or anywhere else in the Middle East, is to resettle them. If they're going to need to be resettled outside their home countries, to resettle them in a zone where they feel more at home from a cultural point of view. There's absolutely nothing to stop the Middle Eastern countries from taking Syrian refugees, except that they would rather see them go to the West because they know that a large quantity of Syrian refugees in the West will do more to destabilize it, and they're quite happy for us to be destabilized. And if we turned it round and said, well, it's a much more humane thing, and we made everybody in the West understand that, then I think it would be far better for everybody. However, it's going to take a little bit of time for us to wake up sufficient people to put pressure on the appropriate governments to make it all happen, but that's what we're here for. It's like Mike said, this all starts off with one person saying that something is not acceptable, and we are
exactly
those people. We understand that there are problems that are currently being handled in a way by our political elites and mainstream media in an unacceptable way, and we're here to say no more. There has to be done in a different way. All these things that we talk about to be handled in a different way, and a solution has to be provided, which is going to be much more beneficial to the West and to our Judeo-Christian civilization in particular. It can be done.
Yeah, I could not agree more with that. And I always say I could not agree more, Tim, because that's why you and I gel so well as a fellow co-host, is that we do totally agree with that. I'm getting close to shutting out the show, though. But one thing I want to remind people,
Tim,
people to go to Radio Jihad Network tonight.
Oh, yes.
At 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And Vito Esposito has a very important announcement. And we want to see all of you there at Radio Jihad Network, Mamma Mia, No Sharia. The host, Vito Esposito, we're going to see you there at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Right, Tim?
Indeed. And for those of you without a calculator, that works out at 11 o'clock Greenwich Mean
Time. 11 o'clock. You got it. Okay,
Tim. That's in 1 hour's time.
We are so done.
Yeah, we are. And
thank you
to
remind
much,
you, you'll see me back here on at the Red Fox Blogger on Friday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, where I fly solo, which kind of makes me kind of scared now because it's kind of hard not to do a show without Tim. But I do a show with Mike Holt on Wednesdays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, so you can see me slinking around there. Tim?
Slinkier the better.
There you go. Wonderful show. Thanks, Tim. I'll talk to you later.
Yeah, thanks, Cal, and thanks everybody on the show and everybody listening.
Thank you,
and,
everybody. Thank you to Mike and Jeff and Tommy and everybody that was part of the discussion tonight. Wonderful, wonderful program. Ladies and gentlemen, Tim and myself, we're over and out. Good night, Tim.
Yeah, good night then, everybody. Good night, Kel. Good night, Mike and Jeff and Tommy and everybody else listening in.
أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله أشهد أن محمد رسول الله
Shut up! Oh my God, I don't care!